Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 23rd of March. It's Monday at 9, which means it's all things political. And we have a lot to talk about, starting, of course, front and center with the economy in the United States. A lot going on this week. We have two guests with us, Abdur Chowdhury, who's a professor of economics at Marquette University, and David Siegel, assistant professor of political science at Florida State University. We'll be looking at what's happening with the stock market. We'll be looking at what's happening with AIG and what has happened, actually, with $170 billion in taxpayer money. Why has it taken such a long period of time for us to learn some of where that money went? Where is the rest of that money? And what about this column from Frank Rich, which really took on the Obama administration yesterday, in which he said it would be foolish to dismiss as hyperbole the stark warning delivered by Paulette Altmaier of Cupertino, California, in a letter to the editor published by the Times last week. President Obama may not realize it yet, but his Katrina moment has arrived. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you care to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Chowdhury, thanks again so much for being with us. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your program.
Yes, our pleasure. And also Professor David Siegel, thank you very much for being with us today. Hello.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Let's start with that comment that Rich quoted yesterday from a letter to the editor in the Times last week. President Obama may not realize it yet, but his Katrina moment has arrived. Has it, Professor Chowdhury?
Yes. I think this is a defining moment in the U.S. economy. Basically, President Obama has to walk a fine line between, you know, he has to take into account the anger that we see in the main street. At the same time, he has to work hand-in-hand with the Wall Street to help us come out from this problem. So this is a moment where he has to be decisive, take policies that would help us to come out from this problem. Yeah, I do think it's a Katrina moment for him. Yes.
Do you agree, Professor Siegel?
I guess it depends on what exactly is meant by that. So on the one hand, I mean, part of the Katrina moment, right, is the perception issue, and part of it is the actual performance. I would imagine it's too early to actually judge the performance at this point in time, but the perception can be partially judged by, you know, public opinion polls, and I'm not sure we're quite at that point yet. I mean, in general, I think the public is still fairly supportive of the new Obama administration.
Mm-hmm. He faces an awful lot on the economic plate this week. We have an announcement about banks from Geithner that's coming today. He's got a press conference tomorrow. What do you think that he needs to tell the president this is, and also the Treasury Secretary? What does he need to do to reassure the American public who are up in arms, particularly about where the bonus money went, but also are up in arms about not having a clear understanding where all our money went to bail out these companies? Professor Chowdhury?
Yes, I think tomorrow's press conference that he has will be important. He has to assure the American people that, you know, the taxpayers' money that are being spent are spent wisely and there is transparency in the system. But having said that, also, we have to realize that, you know, we cannot rule from anger. There is a problem with AIG, the bonus issue. Now, that has led to the House of Representatives, you know, passing this 90% tax rule. So those are the things that I think he has to come to the American people and tell them squarely where we are, what are the problems that we face, and how we can come out from it. You know, mm-hmm. He has to give specific steps.
Do you think there are concerns, Professor Siegel, about who knew what when? There are some reports that Geithner was involved in this bonus decision-making some months ago. There is some concern that perhaps the president knew earlier about the bonuses. Do we need more transparency in terms of who made decisions here?
I think certainly. In particular, for this crisis, which is a sort of a simultaneous crisis of actual decreased value in these credit elements and also perceptual crisis, you can see the market swinging wildly just on the basis of perceptions of how well, you know, a relatively unknown program is going to work or not. And I think it's important for people's confidence in the market that the efforts made by the Obama administration are, you know, forthright, transparent, that we know why decisions were made. This AIG problem in particular is important because it seems, at least, I mean, again, I'm not a legal scholar, but it seems fairly clear that there were ways in which legally one could abrogate some part of that contract for the bonuses, which I think clearly were not necessarily deserved in that case, and yet that was not taken. So the question is, why not, and who chose not to do that, and why?
Mm-hmm. You want to respond to that, Professor Chowdhury?
Yeah, I agree with Professor Siegel on this one. And if I can add just one, the new information that are coming out just this morning, in addition to this AIG scandal that we have right now, you know, I'm calling it a scandal, then we have this new information that J.P. Morgan has spent $165 million buying two Gulfstream jets. It's hitting the news media this morning, so this will be in the news for the next couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what this is doing is this is sort of, in politics, perception is what matters mostly. Basically, shaping public opinion on the stimulus package and Obama's approach to the current financial crisis. And that is something I think the present administration has to be clearly concerned about.
Right. And it's something, we talk about a change of culture in Washington, Professor Siegel. We hear news like what Professor Chowdhury just outlined, and you think, who the heck are these people? You know, it seems to me as though you need to sweep house here.
I'm sorry. So, you mean the new? Oh, I see. So the hold orders from the previous administration, is that what you're referring to?
No, in terms of these people who are running these AIG and JP Morgan and all these jets and their vacations and their huge bonuses. Who are these people?
Well, I think for a long time there's been this perception. And again, I think it's a perceptual problem. I mean, I completely agree with Frederick Chattery's point on the perception issue, but I think it's also true that this perception is fairly large in the business world as well. And there's been this perception that there's a very limited pool of people who are capable of earning these giant profits, and as long as these profits were made, there wasn't really much of a concern about, you know, how they obtained these people, about whether there actually were more people that could have these jobs. And the bonus structure just got, I think, fairly out of hand. But through their oversight from corporate boards. And I think it's going to take a while for sort of corporate culture to shift to recognize that, you know, with increased oversight, increased regulation, it's not going to be as possible to do this anymore.
Mm-hmm. The other news that we were getting over the weekend from reporting from Michael Isikoff from Newsweek is that there are a couple big firms, he mentioned Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan Chase, who have curtailed campaign giving. But, of course, others are giving out money to select members of Congress, particularly those who serve on committees that oversee TARP. What do you think of that, Professor Chowdhury?
Yes, this is a long-standing Washington tradition, tradition, you know, where lobbyists basically, you know, provide money to lawmakers. And I think there has to be a change in the culture in Washington. Unless that happens, this type of contributions will continue. I think this will continue until, you know, there is a change in culture in Washington. And it has to come from Washington.
And the president talks about a change in culture. What about that? Do you see him beginning to change that kind of culture, Professor Siegel?
Oh, I do. I mean, there has been a strong movement towards towards greater transparency. And I mean, I just to give credit where it's due, that credit where credit is due, that did start, I think, in the previous administration, near the end, some increased transparency. But I think there's been a definite movement, strong movement towards greater transparency. And I think that will help matters. I mean, there have been, you know, most campaign contributions are made public. It's just that the attention isn't there in the mass public. To look at these things, and that's one of those tricky questions where it seems on the sort of face of it fairly cut and dry that if, you know, these companies give large sums of money to the to candidates that there should be a fairly, or legislatures, that there should be a fairly clear effect. But if you go through it, I mean, there's been a bunch of studies on this topic, and it seems that if there is an effect, it's not direct in terms of, you know, tit for tat, sort of, I give you money, you vote for my bill. It seems more of a indirect in that the corporate donations help elect the people who will be most supportive in the future to their interests. And there it's difficult. One of the big problems with trying to get that away from that is no matter how transparent you are, as long as that's allowed, as that kind of donations are allowed, that's going to have an influence, and it's difficult to see how you can not allow those donations given, you know, First Amendment issues.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of, there have been calls, as you both know, for Geithner to resign. There has been really a lack of confidence, I'd say, probably among the press. I don't know about the American public in Summers. Does Obama have the right economic team in place here, or does he need somebody who will do something radically different? Professor Chaudhary?
Well, the best possible economic teams that you can gather at this point with Larry Summers, Geithner, Paul Volcker giving advice from time to time. I think I don't see any problem with Geithner. Look what he was handed. When he came to office, Geithner, 2 months ago, he had problems not only in the financial sector but also in other sectors in the economy. And I think he's doing the best that he can. And I don't see any reason why we should be asking for his resignation at this time.
Mm-hmm. What about their connections with these people who got us in pretty deep trouble that makes it impossible for them to have a different perspective?
Yes, but the problem is this. If you think about it, the ones who can bring us out of this trouble are the ones who have a good understanding of how the system works. Geithner, as president of the New York Fed, he was very much involved in policymaking, especially during the last September-October period, when this first thing came into light. And he knows many of the issues, many of the problems, many of the players. So I personally think that he's, given the cards that he was dealt with, he's doing a reasonably good job.
What do you think, Professor Siegel?
I think I largely agree. Again, there's sort of two aspects to this. One is the just actual job of doing it, and there I completely agree. I think it is necessary to have people with the skill set and the connections and the knowledge to really tackle this really difficult problem. The only question would be, in my mind, is if the perception issue had gotten to the point where the market no longer, or the mass public no longer trusted Geithner, in which case then there might be a change necessary. But at this point in time, I don't really see that as, you'd have to see Obama's poll numbers drop, I think, fairly precipitously for that to be sufficient to get rid of someone who has obviously the expertise to be working the problem.
Mm-hmm. And a lighter note, but for many people, a very important note, you do have a garden on the White House lawns now. I thought that was a nice move, Professor Siegel.
I think it is. I think it sends several good messages. And again, given the perceptual importance in politics, right, sending those messages is good, and it provides the country with something to look at other than the exploding economy.
Right. Did both of you have hope that this is going to turn around sometime in the next year? Do we know?
Yes. Personally, I think we will see a turnaround in the second half of 2009. Given the amount of money that has been pumped into the economy, at some point in time, it will start having some impact. So I do see the bleeding in the economy that we are seeing right now to stop somewhere in the second half of 2009.
Professor Siegel? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Are we going, at what point we are going to see a normal growth in the economy? That, I think, will take at least 1.5 to 2 years. So for a normal growth to return, it will be about 2011. But for the bleeding to stop, it will be, I would say, second half of 2009.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have anything to add there. I think I agree. I think a big unknown for me, at least, and trying to guess this, and of course this matters to everyone, is whether or not, is how much of the drop is just due to a panic, and how much is due to actually devalued instruments. That I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I think late 2009 to stop the bleeding, and maybe 2010, 2011 to actually actually sounds right to me.
Let's welcome phone calls for both our guests, and we'll take them in a moment. We're talking all things political this hour of our program, and our guests are Professor David Siegel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Florida State University. Professor Abdur Chowdhury is a Professor of Economics at Marquette University. Our lines are filled right now, but here's the number. Keep it in mind, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now for this All Things Political conversation. Mike from Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Hello, Mike.
I'm from South Milwaukee.
Oh, I'm sorry. Hi.
Okay. I called last week, and I'm calling again. This AIG bonus thing is important, but it's simply a smokescreen. Millions were given in bonuses, but billions were given to corporations, and I say this again, specifically Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs got over $8 billion, more than the entire state of Wisconsin is getting in the stimulus package. Deutsche Bank got $12 billion. Societe Generale, another foreign bank, got over $10 billion. Tim Geithner, and I've said this once and I'll say it again, is a stooge for Goldman Sachs. I'd like your guest to discuss Tim Geithner's role in the bailout at AIG in October of last year and the presence of Lloyd Blankfein, the president of Goldman Sachs, at that Federal Reserve meeting in New York. Will they please discuss that?
All right. Thanks, Mike, for the call. Professor Chowdhury?
Yes, there is some truth to what the caller has just said. Basically, Goldman Sachs did get a good chunk of the money that has come out. But I wouldn't go that far to say that, you know, Tim Geithner has been working in cahoot with Goldman Sachs. I wouldn't go that far to say that.
Professor Siegel?
Yeah, I don't know if I would go that far either. I mean, in some respects, it's a difficult situation he's in. Right? I mean, the two options at the, I mean, the options that they appear to believe are the only two options are deliver money to the major players in the financial industry, or let some number of them go under and see what happens in the ripple effect in the economy. And at the moment, given the choice of the first option, I'm not sure there's an alternative to giving money. Obviously, they could do so with much more transparency and much more regulation over subsequent actions. That's completely true. And there, I think there should be more transparency, but I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that Geithner's a stooge of Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm. Will he ever be able to clear this cloud, though? This news report from the Wall Street Journal today, actually, since the fall, senior aides to Geithner have closely dealt with American International Group on compensation issues, including bonuses, both from his time as president of the Federal Reserve of New York and Treasury Secretary. The extent of their involvement, which wasn't widely known, raises fresh questions about whether Mr. Geithner could have known earlier about the $165 million in bonus payments. He can't seem to get away from all of this. I just wonder what will allow him to forge forward with a plan that will make the American people feel confident and will clear him from past associations. Professor Chowdhury.
Yes, I think this is where Tim Geithner needs to come forward and be forthright and in spelling out his relationship as well as when he knew about this bonus, because this will affect his credibility, not only with the Congress, but also with the American people. And in addition to Geithner, I would also name Chris Dodd, because he was also involved in this whole process. So they do need to come forward with exactly what they knew, when they knew, and their involvement, or the involvement of people in their office with this whole fiasco.
Mm-hmm. And Chris Dodd could be facing some consequences as a result of this, right, Professor Siegel?
It's certainly lesser consequences, potentially other as well. Yes, I mean, I agree completely there. It's always surprising, given the number of times it's come up in American politics, that there's still not the belief that the best solution to any of these problems is to just come out and be forthright and explain exactly what happened and when it happened.
Right,
because usually the cover-up is far worse than the actual problem. And, you know, the American public is fairly forgiving for problems if you're honest about them, but the cover-up's usually not so much.
Right.
So I agree.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Daryl next from Hudson. Hi, Daryl.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My thing is that Obama, his plan would work if he's going in the right direction. Right now, he's not going, in my opinion, he's not going the right direction. There's no accountability. The American people are getting fed up, giving all these banks and these institutions. We had the TARP, in the beginning, and now we got this bailout plan. All this money is going there, and there's no accountability. These AIG, bonuses and everything. I'm in a big company and everything. I get bonuses when I do a good job, yes. But where the company's making a profit, AIG, all these other companies lost money. So that means they didn't make no profit. Therefore, they're not all making. They're not doing a good job. So why should they get bonuses? Where's the accountability?
Mm-hmm. All right, Professor Chowdhury, where is the accountability?
Yes, I agree with the caller on this issue, and this is where I think President Obama has to be forthright this week in his press conference tomorrow. He has to lay down in very clear terms to the American people the crisis, who are responsible, and how he thinks we can come out from this. Accountability and transparency has to explain to the American people. The administration, I don't think, has done a very good job in this regard, and I think Obama has to start addressing this issue.
Mm-hmm.
But having said that, I also think that, as I said earlier, we cannot rule from anger. So there is public anger against this, but we cannot let our decisions be dominated by these anger. So, Obama has to find some sort of a balance.
Professor Siegel.
Yes, no. I mean, I again, largely agree. I would say that this is the one of the, I think, one of the potential problems of, particularly in the last administration with Paulson and Geithner together, of largely utilizing people in the financial industry to fix the problems. On the one hand, they do, as Professor Chatter was saying, know much better the issues involved there. On the other hand, sort of the cultural norms present in this industry do tend to become the norm for their thinking. So a lot of these bonuses, I mean, my impression is that the bonuses, and I agree with the caller in that it seems particularly odd that, usually bonuses are paid for a good job, not, helping to bring down the economy. But in this case, my impression is the bonuses were written as bringing in business, not necessarily bringing in business for a long term. And the short term versus long term perspective, which is really, no one's had a problem with that for the last 4 or 5 years when it was going well for the market, is a lot of the problem that got us in this position in the first place. So this could be a good opportunity to fix some of that perspective, at least for a few years.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Daryl, for your call. Let's go to Zach from Green Bay. Hello, Zach.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that I think last week with the AIG bonus frenzy, it was a prime example of the extreme irresponsibility of the mainstream media once again. They completely fed the frenzy without context, explaining why AIG is uniquely, by far, the most important financial institution as far as preventing a worldwide economic collapse. They did not explained who was responsible for the melding of the banking and insurance industries, which was the cause of this whole thing. And in addition to that, you've got the Republicans who couldn't care less about the country, but will do everything in terms of exaggeration and misinformation for the sole purpose of destroying Obama. And may I say, I consider Wisconsin Public Radio the best source of news that I'm aware of. However, I was dismayed on two occasions last week. WPR hosts did not correct the incorrect information that callers called in saying that the bonuses were 1/100th of the money. In fact, the bonuses were 1/1000th of the money. And part of the problem is people don't understand the perspective of basic mathematics and the impact of all these situations, how they started, etc.
But you couldn't say, could you, Zach, that AIG is quite blameless in not helping contribute in a significant fashion to the whole economic downturn? They weren't angels.
I'm not saying they're blameless. Basically, here we had a frenzy about 1/1000th of the money going to one company, but there was not talk about Who is it that allowed bankers to get into insurance businesses and insurance businesses to get into banking? There was not talk about really the tiny amount of money, relatively speaking, that this was. And the net effect is the destruction of the Obama policy, and that is completely the goal of the Republicans.
Mm. All right,
you know,
Zach.
Misinformation, distraction, et cetera.
Thanks for the call. Do you think that's the goal of the Republicans, Professor Chaudhary?
Obviously, they're gaining some political mileage out of it, so they do have some vested interest in, you know, in finding out that, you know, the policy doesn't work. Yeah, I agree on that issue. But one thing that the caller pointed out is, and which I think is relevant, is he was talking about the point where the Congress changed legislation and allowed investment banking and commercial banking to be done by the same institution. And that did have some impact, although I wouldn't say that's the only reason, but that did have some significant impact on the financial fiasco that we see today. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think that the public outrage, you need something to hang your hat on, and it seems as though the bonuses have been the catch-all here. The American public has a lot to be angry about concerning this issue. We have given these companies huge amounts of our money. It's come out of our pocket. And so now when we look at the fact that they failed us so substantially, we bailed them out, and they're giving their bosses million-dollar bonuses, even if they leave the company. I think that the public outrage is understandable, don't you, Professor Siegel, or not?
Oh, I think it's really understandable. I mean, the two questions. One, is it understandable, and is the media's attention to understand it? But I think I agree completely, yes, that it is. I mean, you can't. I mean, I study terrorism quite a bit, and the same kind of thing there. You can't expect the media not to report on the issue, even though at times reporting doesn't make things better, or is over the top, or too sensationalistic. It just is the nature of the media. They're looking for, you know, some market-driven media, looking for you know, eyeballs, and you can't ignore the major issue. But the other issue is it actually a big deal in and of itself? And I think it is, because it is, in the sense that I think you're right, it's symptomatic of the larger lack of accountability, the lack of attention to the detail, as long as things were going well for these companies. And there should have been more attention to the details during the initial stages of the bailout, in terms of trying to, you know, dot all the I's and cross all the T's and figure out exactly where the money was going. But again, these people were, you know, working on a deadline. They have deal with this problem, and AIG is a substantial, the important glue company for the global financial markets, and it's difficult to, you know, basically rewrite all their contracts on the fly in order to ensure that every dime that the taxpayers are putting in, you know, is going to the right place. So I think we have to recognize there are going to be a lot of mistakes made, and the question is the overall direction the right one?
Right. Let's switch topics here for just a moment. I'm sure that our listeners will bring us back to the economy quickly, but I was interested in the 60 Minutes interview with President Obama yesterday, and he was asked what the most difficult decision was he had to make during the last almost 60 days, and he talked about sending troops to Afghanistan. What do you think of his policy of adding more troops, Professor Siegel, and the difficulty of fighting war? And he also talks about a different kind of strategy in Afghanistan. Do you have a good understanding of what that strategy will be? And do you think that this could be a quagmire for him?
Several questions. So the additional troops, I think, are long overdue. I'm not sure there's anywhere near enough troops to actually solve major problems. I mean, Afghanistan is in a lot of ways a much more difficult problem than Iraq. When we know how that's been going in a lot of ways, due to reasons of geography, of history, rampant corruption in Karzai's administration. The porous border with Pakistan and Waziristan. It's In some ways, it's necessary to try to ensure security, because without security, you really get no progress in state building. On the other hand, I'm not sure. I mean, I think the present troop buildup is another 17,000, which, again, considering the low levels presently, is I think welcome and will help improve security. The question is, will the security improvements spread out from the small regions that the troops are presently patrolling, and that. That depends. I mean, it's pretty much unknown, I think, at this time. Most of the gains in Iraq, which at times were a similar problem, were due to a switch in support of the local population, local elites, from the insurgency and from the foreign fighters in Al-Qaeda in Iraq and such, to their own nascent government formation, and that was the big Sunni awakening and so on. That was the big change. If we want to see Afghanistan not sliding all the way back down, it's necessary that the support of the population does not, switch fully to the Taliban, which means we have to provide the same social services that the Taliban is capable of providing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's difficult without security.
Yeah. Let's go to more calls. Joy from West Bend is next. Hi, Joy.
Hi.
Hi.
I am going to go back to the economy, but it's also related to Afghanistan, because Afghanistan's an area where we need to have access to transportation of oil, and that's one of the reasons why Obama wants to stay in Afghanistan. Anyway, I would like to have a leader talk about a larger vision. If we do have a turnaround or a recovery of the economy, I'm afraid it's just going to be another bubble, because our whole wealth and the reason why, the world population has increased so much in the past so many years is because of oil. We've used oil to make things and build wealth, and now that we're past peak oil, we're never, ever again going to have the ability to have that kind of wealth. So I don't see why somebody doesn't say we can never again expect to have high standards of living that we've had before and the kinds of profits that corporations have had. I guess anybody who says that would not be very popular, not only with the corporations but also with the people. But somebody needs to say that we could figure this out so that energy and food and water are equally distributed throughout the world, and do it without wars. If somebody would have the nerve to say that all this stuff is connected and the economy is never again going to be the same.
Professor Chowdhury.
Yes, I do appreciate the concern that the caller has on this issue. And if you look at the Obama administration's policies, long-term policies, basically one of the things that he has highlighted is the need for alternative energy, the need for us not to be dependent on oil as much as we did in the past. And he also talked about how, there can be a better distribution of water, of other natural resources globally, so that, everyone has a share to that. I think there has been some discussion and some realization on the part of policymakers in this country that we do need to take the global issues into account. We can't simply think of, the U.S. economy, given that we live in this globalized world.
Mm-hmm. Professor Siegel, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. I agree largely, and President Obama does seem to have focus, I think, correctly on a change in energy policy. I will say I don't necessarily think that a global decrease in standard living is inevitable. I do think an equalization of standard living is probably inevitable. So the question is whether technological advance can sufficiently improve the overall standard of living to keep it up.
Mm-hmm. Can you be a little more specific about that? By equalization, you mean everybody has a car, or people live without them, and we all have good mass transit, or what does that mean?
Oh, I mean, it depends. I mean, that I don't know. But equalization itself, as countries develop, there's a limited amount of resources. I think that's what the caller was basically alluding to with oil. There's a limited quantity of resources given present technological development. And as demand increases, the price will increase for all these resources, and the purchasing power will decrease, and equalization in term, by nation should, happen and we'll have less access to these resources ourselves, and our standard of living would decrease unless technology can improve sufficiently to keep it up. So, I mean, what I think a big energy policy and increasing use of alternative fuels and is a big element to keeping standard living up.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. All things political on Monday at 9, always. Our guest, Professor David Siegel, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Florida State University, and Professor Abdur Chaudhury, Professor of Economics at Marquette University. It's a busy week for the president and for particularly members of the economic team. Tomorrow night, the president will have another press conference, and you are invited to join us Tuesday night at 7 for NPR's special coverage of Obama's prime time press conference. Robert Siegel will be your host, and the president will talk about, well, you never know exactly at a press conference, but definitely discussing his economic agenda, executive bonuses at AIG, and he may talk about his trip to Europe for the G20 and NATO summits. So this is tomorrow night at 7, and you will hear it here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Monday, we'll be talking about the meat from grass-fed cows. All right, to Jim now from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi. Quick clusters of ideas. First off, in September, we knew about the deregulation in the contract, so it just adds to the cynicism about the two-party system. Second, under Chapter 11, you could void those contracts, and perhaps the government could still guarantee the AIG so that the world credibility wouldn't collapse. Finally, belief windows and deregulation. Everybody sees the world through a belief window, which has principles which lead to rules, if then, actions and results over time. If people have the belief window of deregulation, look at a deregulated intersection. In a deregulated intersection, you can enter from any direction, any time, any speed, drunk or sober, you're on your own. It's a deregulated intersection. Will the safety in that intersection be better or worse? You want it to be worse. Basically, in the Republican concept of governing, deregulation in any circumstance is going to lead to worse circumstances.
Professor Chaudhury, you want to start?
Yes, I do agree with the caller that the financial mess that we are in today, there are many causes, but one of the causes has been this deregulation that has been going on for some time over the last, I'd say, 10, 15 years, that has contributed to where we are today. So deregulation, the extent of deregulation did play a role. We had deregulation. We didn't have adequate supervision. Now, with Chapter 11 issue, with AIG going for Chapter 11, I do think would have created an enormous problem in the financial market. That would have led to a number of other companies going for Chapter 11. So that's one of the reasons why last September, I think, the Treasury Department wanted to sort of save AIG. So Chapter 11, I don't think would have been a good thing for AIG.
Mm-hmm. Professor Siegel?
Again, I think I said earlier in the broadcast, I mean, there are really two options for, you know, response here. One is to let these companies go on to Chapter 11, and the other would be to give them money. Another possibility is you know, like the Swedish banking system, you take over the banks themselves, government controlled, and then run it. That's something I would like to see more, I guess, argument out of the administration as to exactly why they chose the course they did. I get the sense that they have considered different courses, but are firm on leaving the companies in the mixed public-private sector. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, obviously more transparency as to exactly, you know, what the rationale is behind all the choices there.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, for the call. Let's talk a little bit about the president's trip to Europe for the G20 and the NATO summits. What's on the agenda for the G20 summit, Professor Siegel?
I think the global financial crisis.
Oh, great! I'm sure. More of the same, huh? Yeah.
But there, I mean, one of the major issues is within the European countries. There's almost a crisis in a lack of consensus on what to do. I mean, for all our problems, you can see by the global markets moving every time some mention of our policy comes up. For all our problems, the U.S. is still driving a lot of the policy making, and there's not a lot of consensus among the European countries, despite being in the European Union, of what to do. I think that's going to be a big issue, is sort of come to some kind of consensus for how to manage the global crisis and how to manage that crisis.
Mm-hmm. And what about the NATO summit?
I'd imagine Afghanistan would be fairly irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think the economics would bleed into that as well. It's hard to get away from, really.
Right. And it becomes so big, or maybe I'm making it too complicated, Professor Chowdhury, but it is, the world is so intertwined on this issue, isn't it? So what happens here affects what happens in England, in China. I mean, it's hard to get a handle on all of that.
Yes. As I said earlier, we live in a globalized economy right now. So what happens in Washington does have an impact into what happens in London. Now, this actually links into the G20 meeting in April. Two issues that I think will be discussed at the G20 meeting is, one issue is the Europeans are not as comfortable with stimulus package as the U.S. are. Now, there has been some pressure from the U.S. on the European countries to come up with some sort of a fiscal stimulus package. The European Central Bank, they do not want a fiscal stimulus package to the extent that we did here. So there would be, I think, some discussion on that. The second discussion, I think, at the G20 meeting would be on a report that was just submitted to the G20 countries on having what they call a global economic council that would replace the G20. This was a study that was commissioned by the United Nations, and Joseph Stiglitz basically was the leader of this group, and they submitted their report yesterday, which will be discussed at the G20 meeting.
Mm-hmm.
What they're trying to do is they're saying that if we have a financial crisis, what we did was we used to talk about it at the G7 or G8 meeting. Now, given the globalized nature that we are in, it needs to be discussed at a G20 level meeting. Okay? So they're trying to expand the economic discussion and include countries like China, India, Russia into the discussion, Brazil, Mexico, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's something that will be discussed, and I do see this coming up in the near future.
Let's go to Steve from Rice Lake next. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, good morning.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Yes. I'm lamenting, first of all, where is James K. Galbraith when we need someone to offer us a useful discussion on these issues? I'm sorry to say that I think the two guests here are firmly committed to taking no position whatsoever on any issue. Throughout the whole talk program, for the first 45 minutes, they did not mention deregulation. When a guest finally brought that topic up, Mr. Siegel did not even have the interest in it to let those words cross his lips himself. If we cannot get from these guests useful direction of the conversation toward deregulation is a major problem, toward the myth of the Reagan Revolution and the destruction of government. If we can't get that kind of useful discussion from them, this program is worse than useless.
Well, thanks so much for your call. I think we've covered a lot of territory here. If you would like to take on his comments about deregulation, why don't we center on that for a little while? Professor
sure.
Chowdhury?
This is something I did mention earlier, if you remember, that you know there are a number of reasons that have led to this crisis today. One of the reasons has been the deregulation that has been going on in the Congress for the last 10 to 15 years. One specific deregulatory rule that I talked about was where they said that investment banking and commercial banking, previously they couldn't be done by the same institution, but now that has changed. That has played an important role. Then there was another deregulation where the equity leverage ratio of firms was increased significantly. So what happened was we did have these deregulations over the years, but there wasn't adequate supervision to go along with this deregulation. So they did play a significant role in this financial fiasco that we are in today.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to respond to that?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, the fact that I don't agree with all the sentiments. Obviously, I do agree with the sentiment that deregulation has been a substantial contributing factor to these problems, and I think it's it's true. It's been this way for a while. I mean, I think what the caller maybe isn't considering is that both the economy and the political structure move in cycles. I mean, there are cycles of regulation, there are cycles of deregulation, and typically the deregulation happens after a positive economic cycle, and for some reason no one seems to complain about deregulation while the economy is doing well, at which point eventually there's almost an inevitable bubble, and then the economy does poorly, and then deregulation comes on the radar again of pretty much everyone. I think the difficulty here is that we tend to move to extremes rather than focus on some middle ground. I mean, on the one hand, a level of regulation is absolutely essential, I think, for the economic system. I think we've seen what happens when you have no regulation. I think regulation is important. I think it should have teeth. On the other hand, if you regulate too much, you cut off innovation. And that trade-off, rather than settling on some middle ground, we tend to cycle back and forth between extremes over the years, and I don't think we've really found any kind of optimum.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Chris next from Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning to your guests and to the host. I think you've done a pretty good job of staying on point here, and I think that both Timothy Geithner and his boss bear some real responsibility for being obtuse to symbolism. Make a very quick parallel. The CEOs of the three major auto companies will not fly to congressional hearings in their private jets. They learned the hard way that looks really bad. And by the same token, I think no matter how small a percentage the bonuses were of the total bailout package for AIG, the fact that they existed at all showed, I think, that there's an obtuseness in the White House to how that would look. Sometimes I think maybe what you have to do is you have to find some regular Joe who is not into that whole mindset, that whole groupthink of economics be there and look at things like that and say, no, this is not going to work with the public.
Professor Siegel?
I think certainly much more attention should be paid to these issues in terms of how it looks to the public, and also thinking about the difference in the culture. I was saying before, this culture is pervasive, and I agree. I mean, talking about obtuse, I mean, I think the corporations themselves are grossly obtuse. I mean, the thought. I mean, they're going once they start requesting bailout money, they're going to the public asking for handouts, effectively, and to go in the manners in which they did, it just. I mean, it's absurd.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the fact that they tried in the first place to, you know, they traveled in corporate jets, they kept behind Gulfstreams, they, you know, handled these bonuses, I think the fact that they did so signals, as much as anything, a lack of understanding of how things have changed in the past, you know, year or so.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Chris, for your call. Tom from Mequon, hi.
Hi. I'm wondering what your guests think about since the Clinton era, when they loosened up the laws and encouraged, if not forced, banks to make loans to low-income housing people, especially inner city, that they could not pay. And now these banks have been stuck with bad debt. I'm wondering how much of an effect you think that's had on the economy going down.
Professor Chowdhury, was that the beginning?
This did have some effect. As I said, this deregulation went hand in hand with the lack of supervision. So the idea was, you know, if you can think about it, you know, Clinton wanted to make sure that everyone has access to housing. So, you know, this was done. But then the banks, basically, since there was no supervision, no accountability, so basically the banks went ahead and provided loans to people knowing very well that they won't be able to repay the loans. And these individuals also borrowed money knowing very well that they don't have the income to repay the loan in the future. So all of us played a role in this fiasco, if you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Professor Siegel?
I agree. I mean, I think we're all fully culpable in this, you know.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom, so much for your call. Slattery from Maribel. Hi. Or Mary,
yes.
Where are you from? Maribel.
Maribel.
Yeah. Hi, Slattery.
Good morning to you. I worked in senior positions both in New York and Tokyo for two of the largest financial institutions and dealt with structured securitization, et cetera. And it's just not the issue of deregulation. There are three other points that need to be addressed, I feel. The first is the complexity of the financial instruments are at a level where your regulators are no longer capable and have the experience to be able to evaluate the risk. Second, there's the issue of the non-regulation of financial companies such as finance companies and hedge funds. And third, there is excessive profit maximization that's made by U.S. financial institutions, not just banks, but finance companies, securities firms, hedge funds, et cetera, compared to the level of profits that you find in there's similar firms in other countries in the world, such as Japan. And the fourth point that I want to make is the issue of the rating agencies. The rating agencies are just engulfed by so many financial transactions that they have to regulate that they do not have the time, nor do they have the number of personnel that are needed in regulating these instruments. And that.
And on those points, we'll leave them in our minds because we are out of time. Thank you very much for the call, Slattery. Time just won't allow a response. We do want to thank Professor Chaudhary. Thanks so much for being with us. And Professor Siegel, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having us on your program. Thank you.
Rhonda Fanning, producing the program. Thanks, Rhonda. Rob Schroeder, on-air production. Thank you, Rob.